I want to talk today about, in some ways, about a forgotten episode in Franco-British relations. One of many forgotten episodes, I think. And that is the negotiation of what I would say amounts to the closest intelligence cooperation arrangement in peacetime history before the outbreak of war in 1939, and to, in a way, use it as a case study for what I think is a real habit of forgetting in the history of Franco-British relations and Franco-British cooperation. I was really struck in 2010 when France and Britain signed those two 50-year defense, security, and security cooperation treaties. In the UK, especially, the public sphere was dominated by very, very negative representations of what these treaties might mean. Various talking heads were trotted out to say, why would we want to collaborate with France? They're our traditional enemy. We'd be much better off collaborating with either the Canadians or the Americans, preferably. We get on much better with them. What about the other Five Eyes nations, etc.? And I thought this is another kind of example of this enormous capacity to forget. Forget, for example, the successes of the First World War, which I'll talk about briefly today, but culminated in the formalization of a system of unified command under Marshal Foch. And then, of course, successes even before then, from the Crimean War through to imperial cooperation through the interwar period that Martin Thomas has written quite a lot about. And what I have to say is really typically leaning on the work of many others, not least Isabel and Robert Toombs, but also Martin Thomas, who's sitting next to me, Simon Kitson, who's not here, sadly, Talbot Imlay, who's not here either, and especially Emily Hare, a PhD student at Queen's University in Belfast, who wrote an excellent thesis on Franco-British intelligence cooperation in the first half of the 20th century that I examined about a year ago. The central conclusion I want to offer today is that there was no systematic collaboration in intelligence matters, really until the very eve of war for French soldiers and statesmen in the late 1930s. The hope was that, quite apart from their practical utility, intelligence exchanges would be an initial step towards a full-blown military alliance with the British, and this is precisely what most British policymakers did not want right through until virtually the eve of war. And as a result, the British defense establishment was extremely reluctant to pool its intelligence resources with those of France before the Second World War. In this sense, the question of intelligence collaboration paralleled the larger pattern of political and military relations between France and Britain. True cooperation was undertaken too late and without sufficient commitment, but when it happened, eventually, it constituted the closest peacetime intelligence alliance in history. And I just want to just define quickly what I mean by intelligence alliance, because I don't think many of us here are all that familiar with the esoteric field of intelligence studies that I work in now and again. Intelligence studies scholars have tended to categorize different levels of intelligence cooperation. The first level is limited and sporadic exchanges of information, which are characterized by quite a lot of mistrust. A more systematic and closer relationship of cooperation involves institutionalized formal structures for information sharing. And my own view is that we should add two more levels to this. The first would be the existence of structures for the joint assessment or analysis of intelligence information. I think this is important. It's relatively rare. And then the most intimate, the closest and most systematic form of intelligence alliance, which only really qualifies the term alliance, is when there are also structures for in-depth collaboration in both assessment and even the collection of intelligence. And I think that's exemplified most strikingly by the Five Eyes intelligence alliance that involves Britain, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand nowadays. During the First World War, there were rudimentary structures in place for joint assessment, but there were no formal structures developed to coordinate efforts to collect both open and secret information. By the opening of the Second World War, however, the British and French intelligence communities had gone much further to lay the foundations for a genuine intelligence alliance. Progress had been slow, however, and much remained to be done when war broke out. And it is important to remember that during the 1930s, there was no precedent for methodical exchange of foreign intelligence between states in peacetime. No formal kind of structures existed between states. There were conferences held by various states to share information, primarily France and its allies in Eastern Europe, but there was nothing that was institutionalized within the machinery of government. Nor had the experience of war, the First World War, driven home the need for this peacetime intelligence cooperation. After 1918, in fact, a number of political, bureaucratic, and even psychological or cultural obstacles emerged to inhibit Franco-British intelligence cooperation. But there were important precedents in the First World War. And one was the presence of large and growing, through the course of the war, secret intelligence missions, the French Service de Renseignement and the French Counterintelligence Agency, the Section de Centralisation de Renseignement, in Britain, in London especially. There were also large British missions, there's a large Mission Anglaise in Paris as well. And there was an organ that we know relatively little about, which is a bit of a shame. It was called the Bureau Central Interallié, whose aim was to ensure cooperation between general staffs. That was its aim. And it was staffed by military missions from all Allied powers. But it was dominated by Britain and France. And its chief function was really the centralization, the collation, and the dissemination of incoming intelligence, including secret intelligence. It was crucial, for example, to the coordination of information coming in on the German order of battle. That was its most important role. But also counter-espionage, and above all, the management of the blockade. The blockade was, this is another story that's not that well understood, the role of intelligence in what was a very successful Allied blockade during the First World War. And the chief output of this Bureau Central Interallié was what were called daily résumés des renseignements parvenus dans les 24 heures. In other words, every day there was a summary, a synthesis of all incoming information, which is distributed to all of the Allied staffs, general headquarters in both the European Theater of Operations, but also in London. These were not always based on all available intelligence, as is quite typical in multinational arrangements. The cooperating parties did not share everything. The British, for example, had a system that classified levels of intelligence sharing, which are very evocative of the system that prevails to this day. The first level was to be sent to the BCI, the Bureau Central, for wider circulation. The second level was for United Kingdom and France only, and the most sensitive information was for UK representatives on the Bureau only. And this is a good example of how intelligence sharing happens in multinational arrangements for intelligence liaison. It would be later replicated and is replicated today, for example, in organizations like NATO. And it did. This Bureau Central did provide a model for intelligence cooperation in peacetime. However, this model was quickly forgotten. There was, very quickly after the Paris Peace Conference, most of this machinery was wound up and it was dismissed, with the exception of cooperation amongst the French and British militaries in the occupation zones of the Rhineland. But even then, that relationship was characterized by acute tension most of the time. And now to go on to the political and cultural context during the war very quickly. Formal structures for intelligence cooperation between Britain and France were abandoned relatively swiftly, as I mentioned, after the Paris Peace Conference. If a strong sense of common threats and the need for common solutions are often important prerequisites or drivers for intelligence cooperation, then it's scarcely surprising that Britain and France did not forge an intelligence alliance after the First World War, because for most of the interwar period, British and French relations between Britain and France were characterized more by discord than collaboration over most European questions. The incomprehension that existed between the two countries is all the more striking given the relative intimacy of the wartime alliance, but as several people in this room have written. In fact, it was the experience of the war that in many ways, divergent experience of the war, that drove Britain and France apart, and especially this British conviction that it had been a mistake to offer any kind of a military commitment to France in peacetime. After 1918, and after the divergent interests of the two powers emerged ever more clearly, on the British side, much has been written about the extreme reluctance of the political and military leadership even to discuss any kind of military arrangements at all. And this stemmed to a large extent, as I mentioned, from the widely held conviction that Britain had been drawn into the war and had made unnecessary and imprudent commitments on the continent during staff conversations with the French before 1914. On the French side, there was also a sense of Anglo-Saxon betrayal after the British and Americans reneged on pledges given to guarantee French security during the Paris Peace Conference. And during the 1920s, differing approaches to the German question in European politics drove the French and British governments ever further apart. This was added imperial rivalry and all kinds of cultural impediments to cooperation that we really don't have time to get into. There was, however, even right throughout the period, there was, however, rudimentary exchanges of information between the French and the British, in particular because the British lacked any real substantial sources on the course of German rearmament, especially after the Nazis came to power, Nazi National Socialists, in 1933. The French response to this British lack of information was to bombard the British with many hundreds of reports detailing all kinds of German violations of the Versailles Treaty. But the problem was that while Germany was indeed guilty through the 1920s and early 30s of all kinds of violations of the Versailles Treaty, French assessments of German military potential tended to be vastly exaggerated. And these exaggerations were a product of French prudence on the one hand, also French anxiety about German war potential, but they were intended to impress upon the British the need for a large French army. The result, however, was that the credibility of military intelligence estimates was undermined, not only undermined in the eyes of the British, but also amongst many French policymakers. British officials tended to dismiss what they referred to in Whitehall as French disarmament propaganda, intelligence assessments of the growing threat from National Socialist Germany. On the British side, there were also deep-seated apprehensions regarding France's political instability and the danger, the perceived danger, of a Bolshevik revolution in France. The ways of French politics are incalculable, complained Orme Sargent, a Foreign Office mandarin, in 1935. And the advent of the Popular Front set alarm bells ringing in Whitehall in 1936. In June 1936, Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden feared that France was, and I quote, growing more red over the course of the summer of 1936. Later that year, Cabinet Secretary Maurice Hankey judged that France was, and I quote, inoculated with the virus of communism, which is at present rattling the body politic and causing acute internal dissension. In her present state, France is not a very desirable ally. Likewise, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of the Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Chatfield, Ernie Chatfield, considered that, and I quote, France, our only real support, is unreliable politically and militarily, especially politically. There were therefore obvious contradictions in British attitudes toward France, interestingly. France was both militarist, as it was suspected of being, it was also criticized for being excessively pacifist, and its policies were either too intransigent or too lethargic. And this is, I think, a trend that goes throughout the interwar period. Frustration with French militarism was combined with anxieties over the slow pace of rearmament. The crucial point, however, is that within the British official mind, there existed grave doubts about the stability of the Third Republic and thus its reliability as an alliance partner. And this shaped, in important ways, British attitudes towards intelligence cooperation. Another problem was the location of intelligence, especially secret intelligence in France, was firmly within the French general staff, and especially within the general staff of the French army. And this meant that any formalized exchanges of intelligence with France seemed to suggest the existence of staff conversations, which was absolutely anathema to most British policymakers. And this was, of course, in a sense, stood in very stark contrast with the situation in Great Britain, where the Secret Intelligence Service was located under the auspices of the Foreign Office, as was the British Code-Breaking Service, the Government Code and Cipher School. And this has stood in very stark contrast to the French situation, where intelligence and intelligence culture in France, to quote Doug Porch, was dominated by the military. And this is also, as I mentioned, a real impediment to systematic intelligence cooperation. So there was, however, as I mentioned, sporadic cooperation to late 1938. There were frequent exchanges concerning the situation in Europe. There's also information sharing across the two empires, from Tangier to Shanghai. There were informal meetings, often between top-ranking intelligence officials, extensive collaboration in the field, and in fact, as in many of the cases when we look at the question of cooperation between intelligence communities, quite often some of the important drivers are personal relationships between intelligence officials that serve together in a certain city, et cetera, et cetera. And this was going on all the time, especially in the empire, and Martin has written interestingly about this, especially the British and French empires in the Maghreb and Levant. So until the late 1930s, however, the most common form of cooperation was regular contact between service attachés that would share information. There was also, however, quite intimate information exchanges over the question of communist subversion or Bolshevik subversion. This is one area where the British were very happy to cooperate very closely with the French because they were worried about the spread of communism inside France. And the diary, for example, of the chief of the Service de Renseignement from 1935 through into the Second World War, Louis Rivet, Colonel and then General Louis Rivet, provides a really interesting picture of the cadence of meetings with his British counterparts, really. But also, some of the new archives that have come to France from Moscow since the 1930s also give a very interesting picture of the focus of intelligence exchange. In general, the British sent the French information they gathered about communist subversion in Europe and especially in France, because they were worried because after the Nazi takeover, the Comintern had set up its main European headquarters in France, but also the activities of the Communist Party in Great Britain. And this information was transmitted either through face-to-face meetings between Stuart Menzies, mainly the deputy chief of SIS, and Rivet, or his deputy, Major Malraison, or sometimes through Wilfred Biffy Dunderdale, who was the SIS station chief in Paris in this embassy. And so the information that was shared, the tenor of the information they shared, was really about the importance of the communism. And in fact, Menzies, when he meets with Rivet, he provides a document laying out what he wants to talk about beforehand, and this is in June 1936, just after the Popular Front government comes to power in France. And Menzies warned that if the British and French secret intelligence efforts were concentrated too exclusively on Germany, and this is what the French were arguing for, and I quote, "We run the risk of losing sight of the growth of other movements, which could suddenly, and to our surprise, assume considerable importance. I am convinced that we would be taking a terrible risk if we do not keep a careful watch over the machinations of an organization, the Comintern, whose intentions are, in the final analysis, indubitably just as dangerous as those of our neighbors in Central Europe." And this is a kind of speaking to Germany. "We have proof," Menzies added, and I quote, "that the revolutionary attitude activity of industrial workers here is controlled by instructions from various international committees in Paris." And so Menzies was trying to argue that the Franco-British intelligence cooperation should focus at least as much on communism as on Germany. This is in 1936, when Germany is beginning to rearm very seriously. The French are arguing, no, in fact, we need a much more broad and comprehensive effort, collaborative effort, that's focused on Germany. The British are very reluctant to sign up to this. And this is, I think, illustrated quite interestingly during the Spanish Civil War, where Admiral Darlan, who is the deputy chief of the naval staff, travels to London to try and convince the British Admiralty to share intelligence with the French Navy on the situation in the Mediterranean. The British absolutely want no part of this. And Darlan has refused an audience with the First Lord of the Admiralty, also refused an audience with Morris Hankey, the cabinet secretary, and is put off by Ernley Chatfield, the First Sea Lord, the key position in the Royal Navy. And even his superior, Admiral Georges Janvier, who is chief of staff, makes another effort later on in that year, and he's also rebuffed. And the British Admiralty circulates a note through the cabinet saying, the French staffs, true to their traditional policy of trying to tempt us with an alliance or understanding, are always keener on staff talks than were we British. And so there's a real reluctance right to the eve of war. This changes, however, after the events of Munich, the Czechoslovak crisis, after the Anschluss and the Czechoslovak crisis in March and September 1938, and in particular after a war scare, which interestingly, I haven't got time to get into this, is orchestrated partly by Sir Henry Pownall, who's the director of military intelligence, who encourages the French to send alarming assessments of the European situation to London in order to convince his superiors, Pownall's superiors, that they need to take cooperation with the French more seriously. And this results ultimately in a British offer of formal and systematic staff talks. And the first thing the French ask for as part of this arrangement is systematic intelligence sharing. And the French military attaché in London, General Albert Lelong, observed with an interesting mixture of bitterness and relief that, and I quote, at last one sees a widespread recognition of the need for close Franco-British collaboration in the face of further aggression. And as a result of this, detailed arrangements are established between the French and British general staffs. There is movement first toward constructing machinery for joint assessment, and intimate agreements are negotiated between the Service de Renseignement on the one hand, the French service, and SIS on the other, to share out where the services are going to focus their efforts on collecting secret intelligence primarily through agent networks. And so on the one hand, at the level of general staffs, machinery for joint assessment of intelligence is beginning to emerge on the eve of war. There's also this intelligence collection arrangement, gotcha, Richard, whereby not only the assessment information is going to be coordinated, but also the collection of information. This is another level of intimacy, I think. And it's also expressed in close Franco-British cooperation over the attack on the Enigma machine, which goes right through into the Second World War. It's very interesting. It's a long story. But the Poles had been secretly, using intelligence passed to them by the French, had been secretly breaking into Enigma traffic. That is the German Enigma cipher machine used by the German police and armed services to communicate. Since 1934. However, in 1938, the Germans added two more rotors onto the Enigma machine, which made it much more complicated mathematically to solve, and they had to come clean and admit that they had been reading Enigma traffic and not telling either France or Great Britain. But they also had to ask for help, and as a result, there's very close cooperation between the French Signals Intelligence Unit, Section D, under Major Gustave Bertrand, and the British government code and cipher school, which in the end, as we all know, resulted in the first successes into Enigma traffic, which came about not long before the eve of war. But the arrangements that are made, and the documents are now there in the British archives, very interesting. As soon as any keys are broken, they're transmitted. There's a special teleprinter set up in Paris to transmit the key, the daily key, which is what you need to read the Enigma traffic. The T is the setting of the rotors, which that's transmitted immediately to London. And if the British break it, they transmit it immediately to Paris. And this is happening. And there are also British and Polish code breakers in what's called PC Bruno, the French code breaking signals intelligence unit set up, which is the first one to start breaking into German Luftwaffe Enigma. And this is a result of really detailed cooperation of a kind that's comparable, at least in the levels of intimacy, to the UK-USA agreement that's negotiated by Sir Harry Hinsley and the British team in the United States in 1943. And so what we see really on the eve of war is the emergence of a very, very growing and increasingly intimate and sophisticated intelligence alliance of a kind that has no precedent in peacetime in the history of international relations, as far as I'm aware. And this is an episode, at the same time, that's forgotten almost completely in much of the literature one reads about Franco-British relations. It's a very interesting precedent in some ways for the special relationship the United Kingdom negotiates with the United States toward the middle of the Second World War. And that's probably the key point I wanted to make today, so thanks very much.